Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The gloves come off in the only state Supreme Court debate ahead of April 4th. We recap the highlights. Plus, tough on crime was the central theme at the state capitol this week. We tell you what GOP-authored bills Governor Tony Evers said he'd sign. And the housing market took a hit over the last year. We detail a new report by the Wisconsin Realtors Association and what it means for home buyers. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for March 24th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., a lot to cover this week, but first we're going to start with a state Supreme Court debate that we were on the panel on. And I guess you could say it was the gloves came off. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit spicy exchanges because this is the first and only time we're going to see them share a debate stage before the April 4th election. So we're going to talk about some of the highlights. But throughout the debate, the candidates really just took the opportunity to tie their opponent to partisan politics and attacked another on the big issues centering in this race, including abortion, redistricting, crime, and the massive amounts of money that is fueling this high-stakes race. First, I want to talk about some of the takeaways, and then we're going to hear a clip of kind of the candidates going back and forth on the issue of abortion. Some things that we found out is that Kelly said he would not accept campaign funds from the state Republican Party after stating a few weeks ago he would welcome their support. Now, he's still getting some support from them when it comes to communication, get-out-the-vote efforts, and research, but said he's not going to take money specifically. Protase was also suggested to a question that you asked, JR, about changes to settled case law when it comes to conservative big victories that they tout a lot, like Act 10, absentee ballot drop boxes, when the court got rid of them, and the governor's emergency party. She suggested that there could be possible changes if she's elected to the court. Also, one thing, and I think the only thing that the candidates agreed on, is that they signaled support for a proposed constitutional amendment that will be on the April 4th ballot that would give judges more discretion when setting bail amounts. Now, this has been something that the legislature passed, wrote the language, so all voters will be seeing that question on their ballot. Now, let's get to kind of some of the spats that we heard. Specifically, we're going to hear from Protasiewicz and Kelly on the issue of abortion. Let's take a listen.
I am running against probably one of the most extreme partisan characters in the history of this state. I have been very clear about my values to the electorate because I think the electorate deserves to know what a person's values are rather than hiding them. But I can tell you that if my opponent is elected, I can tell you with 100% certainty that 1849 abortion ban will stay on the books.
Yep, that's absolutely not true, once again. So this seems to be a pattern for you, Janet, just telling lies about me. So you don't know what I'm thinking about that abortion ban. You have no idea. These things you do not know. What I know is this. The endorsements that I receive are entirely because of conversations that I have with individuals and organizations in which they ask me, what kind of a justice will you be?
So looking at both of their performances, Kelly was much more aggressive, mm-hmm. much more putting attacks towards Protasiewicz when it came to her record on crime and the issues, like I mentioned, abortion. He once again called her out for prejudging on how she would rule from the bench because she talks about her values and beliefs. Then we also saw Protasiewicz kind of go after Kelly a lot for his ties to the Republican Party, January 6th and whatnot. So what are other maybe some things that stood out to you, JR?
So we've often talked about you don't win a campaign anymore in a debate. You can lose one. So I was watching for, was there a viral moment where anybody something so egregious would come in and end up in campaign ads? And when I do to moderate debates, I have a hard time enough keeping things straight, like the question order, what's going on. I'm not really taking notes in my head. But I listened for any of those moments, and I didn't sense one. So I called about a half dozen people after the debate and said, did I miss them? Did you see something? They said no. There wasn't a moment they felt like that crystallized, aha, this is going to be a trajectory changer. And one thing that kind of came up was little things that you and I might notice, but the average person wouldn't. For example, if this debate were graded on who did the best job, like for a high school debate team function, right? I think Justice Kelly probably would have gotten the win in that regard. If it was about who knows the Constitution best, probably also in his column. Protasiewicz at times a little more unsteady in her answers, a little bit, you know, she had this moment at the very beginning about like the timer, wasn't sure how that was working. At the same time, Kelly kept calling her Janet over and over again. He has a tendency to come off a little bit condescending, like he's a very smart man and comes off like he knows it. So in talking to people, it kind of felt like, you know, if you were an undecided female voter who's really kind of the key in these races anymore, the abortion at play, were you turned off by what Kelly did? If you watch Protasiewicz and go, well, she's been a DA and a judge and she's a little shaky, does that turn me off, make me question if I'm ready for her? The thing is, that undecided female voter is not watching the debate. Mm-hmm. And that's a reality. For all the hours we put into it,
yeah,
people aren't really tuning in as much as those who already made up their minds. It's the coverage, it's that moment you're watching for. So I don't really think change the trajectory of this race because of that debate. It was more stuff that people like you and I will go, oh, that was really interesting, or I want to pick that apart, than the average person going, I've changed my mind now because of what happened.
Yeah, and we haven't seen any ads. Of course, the debate was just on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. It's more, I think, for the social media aspect. I've seen the Kelly campaign kind of capitalize on some of the aha moments that I like to say are good for TV mm-hmm. moments. He had a moment where he said, you know, there you are again, once again, Janet, lying about me. You have no idea how I'm going to rule on this abortion issue. We just heard it here on the show, too, from that clip. But what comes out of it, right? I mean, if you really want to get into the weeds as a voter and want to watch the hour debate, of course, well, go ahead. We would love you to, because we put a lot of hours into it. But yeah, I don't think there'd be a campaign per se ad come out of it.
No.
All right, let's move on to session this week, because both the Senate and Assembly were in, and the overall theme was about crime. And the biggest issue that I would say that got bipartisan support was about reckless driving. Of course, it's been a huge issue in Milwaukee, but, you know, it goes and trickles across the state. So what the reckless driving bills would do is a bipartisan package. Fines would be increased to $400 for a first offense, and repeat offenders would have their car impounded by police if they fail to pay fines from a prior offense under a companion bill. Now, that would only go into effect if a municipality votes to allow police to do that. We also saw some bipartisanship on overdose deaths, addressing that because of the fentanyl crisis here in the state and across the nation. What it would do is would raise reckless homicide penalties for delivering fatal drugs from 40 years in prison to 60 years. So that bill was spearheaded by Senator Van Wangard, and we heard Senator LaTanya Johnson speak on this bill too, because she has a personal story about losing one of her brothers to an overdose death. Let's first hear from both of them on the floor about this bill.
In 2021, my middle brother, it's three of us, had his leg amputated from prolonged cocaine use. Shortly after that, about 2 months after, I lost my youngest brother to an overdose. The one thing that I want more than anything is for the person who sold my brother his drugs to be caught, to be punished. I don't give a damn if this bill doesn't stop people from using. I do give a damn that it takes the person off the street who is killing other people because of their addictions. Addicts don't want to die. They don't choose to die.
This is reckless homicide when you give poison to somebody and they die. That is the narrow focus of what this piece of legislation, what this statute already does. We're not changing the substantive part of the statute. We are just increasing the penalty. Anybody that can feed this chemical to somebody and intentionally feed it to them and they die as a result of that needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be a uniform application of the law. And it's not you're going to get 60 years, it's up to 60 years. So it gives the judge a lot of latitude if those individuals cooperate during the investigative part of what the officers are doing.
Also, just want to briefly mention some other Republican bills that did not get bipartisan support that passed this week. One would deal with felons who are charged with gun possession. They would be required to serve a minimum 5-year prison sentence, and anyone who encourages in a riot or participates in one that turns violent would face a felony charge. Now, both of these bills, at least the riot one, has been previously vetoed by Governor Tony Evers. The one about felons being charged with gun possession, facing stiffer penalties, Evers is also unlikely to sign that because critics say that it would kind of exasperate the inequalities that already exist in the criminal justice system. But what we did hear from the governor on the bills that he said he would sign is reckless driving. So this could very well be the first bills that he signs this year.
See, they can get something done.
They can.
It's amazing.
It's exciting.
So noteworthy there. I mean, there are still some Democrats who aren't happy because they feel like you're not addressing the root problem of this. You're upping the penalties. Still, overwhelming number of people voted for it. Big bipartisan support. One thing I'm noticing in the Senate, too, is you're seeing a couple, three Democrats who will break with others and vote for crime bills. Brad Paff from La Crosse, his district is not deep blue that much anymore. And Bob Wirch down in Pleasant Prairie. There are many interesting votes to watch on some of these crime bills going forward. The other thing I want to point out is there was a bill this week about, it's a trailer bill to the constitutional amendment. So remember the amendment on the ballot on April, there are two questions about it with bail and what judges will be able to do in terms of how they set bail. This trailer bill defines some things that are key for that decision, especially what is violent crime, like what are bodily harm, I think it is. That passed on party line votes. I'm watching to see what happens if Evers signs that bill, because backers have said without that bill, it's, in their words, the Wild West with that amendment, because you don't have parameters for judges. What are they going to do? You have a wide latitude then about how to set bail. So we're really going to watch that one and see if that gets signed into law, if the amendment's passed. And two, if it doesn't, if Evers vetoes it, what do they know? Can they negotiate a deal to get something to work? Because that leaves a big piece out of the amendments. And you could argue it's Republicans' fault. They want an amendment on the ballot this spring. They want to get it through. They did not address this question during the process earlier. They left it up to chance now with this bill. We got, again, a party line vote in both houses.
And just to clarify for voters, too, because I know I've been getting a lot of questions in our newsroom about this specifically, is that there are three ballot questions. One is the definition of violent crime. The other one is if you support the bail amendment in general to give judges more discretion when setting bail. And the third is about stiffer requirements for welfare recipients. That one is non-binding. So the two related to bail have to pass together. And then, like you said, if Governor Evers doesn't sign the bill, that was Representative Duco that said it would be essentially the Wild Wild West for judges. So there's just some clarity there for people. If you haven't voted yet or if you got your absentee ballot and say, these two questions look very similar, it's because they do. I mean, the language is almost the same, but you know, we have several articles out there if people have questions
and
about
it. And that third question you bring up, we asked weeks ago, will we see money spent to promote that referendum question?
Yeah.
Just saw a filing this week from a group called Keep Wisconsin Working. They're doing TV, digital, I think radio as well, to promote the referendum. Now, people generally believe that if you go ask people, should able-bodied trans adults have to meet work requirements to qualify for benefits, they'll probably say yes. It's more about getting people motivated to turn out April 4th, maybe help Daniel Kelly on the ballot. But we are seeing money being spent in that regard, so that's worth noting that it actually did come to fruition. There's money being spent on that.
And the abortion issue is living on in the state capitol this week. Democrats were joined by Governor Tony Evers as they introduced a bill that would basically put the rights back in place before Roe v. Wade was overturned. So it would repeal the 1849 criminal abortion ban. It was Representative Subek who actually introduced almost the exact same bill about 2 months ago. But they're renewing this effort after just a week when Republicans in both chambers couldn't even reach mutual agreement on a bill to add exceptions for sexual assault and incest to the 1849 ban. Now, we talked to Voss this week, asked him about, well, are you going to bring that bill up to the floor, even though Senate Republicans and Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue says, no way, Jose, that's not coming in my chamber. Voss said he still wants to hold a vote. So when he decides to do that, we'll see. But let's just hear first from Governor Tony Evers, kind of explaining, once again reiterating, the polling shows a majority of people, you know, want those rights restored. And he also called for, hey, let's have a debate on the issue. And what he means by that is let's bring both bills to the floor. Let's have all these members vote on it and see where people stand. Voss kind of dismissed those comments. Mm-hmm. So let's take a listen.
People in Wisconsin have talked about this time after time after time. through polls and otherwise. You heard a doctor talk about the extraordinary impact of this 1849 law on women's lives in the state of Wisconsin. We know what the polling says. The minimum that we should have is an open debate.
I think the thing that's been the most disappointing is the extreme stance that Governor Evers has taken, which is it's basically his way or the highway. There's no negotiation. I think most Republicans, and I hope most Democrats and independents, agree that we need to update the definition of health of the mother. And I think that we know that in the public, 90% of the public supports adding exceptions, even the vast majority of Republicans. So it seems like the only person standing in the way of that is Tony Evers.
So like I mentioned, Voss wants to go through with this regardless, put his members on the record. But Jer, I guess, why does he even want to do that if it's not even going to go anywhere?
So first, I'm still in a wait-and-see mode about whether he gets 50 votes to pass it. I doubt he'd bring it to the floor without that. That would look kind of bad. But let me go down a rabbit hole for a second. Let's say Janet Prosiewicz wins the Supreme Court race in April. Let's say there is a challenge to the maps we currently have for legislative seats, and let's say that challenge is successful. The maps are redrawn in a much, quote-unquote, fairer way than much more swing seats. If you're a caucus that has been basically shielded from swing voters for more than a decade and have a lot of competitive seats all of a sudden, you may have to adjust to this issue because you're on the wrong side of it politically. Now, I'm not arguing morals or anything like that, but politically, we've seen that this is a very difficult issue for Republicans in fall electorates. You may want to get a vote to get members in those swing seats on record showing that you are, quote unquote, reasonable on the issue because the campaign ads that will be coming. Now, that's a lot of what ifs, mm-hmm. but I'm trying to game out like what might be a motivation to bring this up, knowing it's not going to go anywhere, because there is a political component to this, and that is until there is some resolution about the 1849 ban, whether it's struck down by the courts, it's whatever happened, changed legally, as long as that remains in effect, Republicans are in a box on that issue. And no, especially November elections, they're going to face a difficult environment without an answer for how to address that.
And like you mentioned, a lot of this depends on who gets elected to the mm-hmm. state Supreme Court. Now let's move on to the Building Commission, who met this week. Governor Evers, every budget cycle, proposes his capital budget. And the past two times he has, it's kind of a similar trend that Republicans rejected. So they voted 4-4, and when the commission is tied on a vote, the building projects fail. Governor Tony Evers, in a quote, said, "While Republican leaders claim to support these goals, their action today shows that they would simply rather play politics than have a meaningful discussion on how these projects would serve Wisconsinites." Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahieu said legislative Republicans will continue to work to provide cost-saving costs for taxpayers by holding the Evers administration responsible. In his statement, Lemahieu also kind of explained further that with, you know, inflation right now, costs are high. Construction projects are costing a lot more than they used to. You know, let's take a step back. So ultimately, we'll see what projects get approved, but trying to just to point out this is the similar trend that we see every budget cycle.
So it used to be the Building Commission process was almost a formality in the budget. So, and really the commission is not the final step with the capital budget. It's always the Finance Committee and the full legislature. But 4 years ago was the first time believed that the commission deadlocked on a recommendation to the Joint Finance about building projects. So no recommendation. Now, these all still go to Joint Finance. They still have mm-hmm. this document with these proposals. The question is, where will they pare it down to, just like they did in 2021 and 2019? This one is $3.8 billion. Of that, just shy of $2 billion is cash. So normally, like if you're buying a house, you take out bonds to pay for projects in the state. They're 20 years, much like, you know, a 30-year mortgage for a house, because it's a long-term project. Evers argues by doing cash, you are saving money in the long term, I think about $1 billion in payments. Joan Baldwig is a member of the Building Commission, also a member of the Finance Committee. I caught her after the Building Commission yesterday and asked, hey, are you guys talking about an appropriate level of spending in the capital budget? 2 years ago, for example, Evers wanted to do like $2.3 or $4 billion. You got pared back to like $1.6-ish. You know, where are you guys talking? So we're talking, haven't found a decision yet. The cash thing, though, she said, yes, it's attractive, you save money, but like if you're buying a house, usually without cash, you put it in the down payment or buy more better curtains, you don't pay the entire thing up front. And the reason is the more you put into paying things with cash, the less you have for tax cuts and other things. As a side note, we've talked about that budget surplus, $7 billion end of this fiscal year. The fiscal did a memo this week about the one-time uses of money in the budget that Evers proposed. It's about $6.6 billion in one-time funds. So the big things were he wants to move money to the budget stabilization fund. We already have a lot of cash there, like $1.8 billion, $1.7 billion. He wants another half billion over there. He wants to up the statutory balance, which is how much you have to have in your checking account, essentially, in the very budget. That's more than $1 billion there. There's also the Brewer's money, paying off transportation bonds. What I'm getting at, he does have a lot of one-time expenses in there to use the one-time money. That also means less cash for one-time tax cuts or, you know, like any pet project. So what I'm getting at is watch the Finance Committee. First, where do they end up? What's an appropriate amount of spending that they think there should be in that? And then two, how do they pay for it? Do they want to do more cash or do they want to do, you know, the bonding we usually do for these projects? Because again, if you're going to build a building, usually you occupy it for 40, 50 years in the state government. So is it smart to pay it all in cash over a 2 or 3 year period versus paying it over time? You're going to occupy it over that length of time.
And speaking of joint finance, next week they do start sitting down with agency heads to begin the whole budget cycle of how they're going to rewrite it. But first they listen to agency head Fertz and move on. So that is something that will be happening next week on Tuesday and Thursday at the state capitol. Also to an issue that I know is personal for me, the housing market, and to many Wisconsinites. There was a new report by the Wisconsin Realtors Association that kind of once again kind of sets a very challenging time and challenging reality of what's going on. I know for me right now and many others. The report shows that home sales fell by 28% in February of this year compared to February of last year, while the median price of homes rose by nearly 12%. So what this means is that demand is still high even while prices are high, but inventory is low. So while you want to buy a home and maybe you have the savings to do it, there's not that many on the market for you to choose from. So the amount of money, too, is about nearly $30,000 of how much homes have increased just in the past year. Now, I talked to an economist. I talked to some realtors as well about this issue. And there's many factors behind this. Of course, you know, mortgage rates as well, but also the construction industry. There's a shortage of workers. There's a shortage of supplies. That means they're building less houses. Also, COVID. During the pandemic, mortgage rates were very, very low. They were very cheap, and then they went to sky high. And realtors that I spoke to and are speaking to, they also say they're seeing more younger single people buying family-sized homes. So that also takes it off the market from married couples and families looking to move into these larger homes. So just kind of putting it into perspective of people, will things get better? Economists say, well, if we don't fall into recession, it's going to take a little while till the housing market rebounds.
Remember, one of the big buzzwords in this budget has been workforce housing,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yep.
Evers has a number of proposals in there. We've also seen Republicans talk about workforce housing for several years. The Assembly seemed more ginned up to do a workforce housing package last session. What I'm watching is, will anything that Evers proposed survive in this budget? And two, if not, will we see Republican lawmakers take up the torch and try and pass something of their own to address the issue?
All right, let's get to stock picks. We're going to start with a topic that happened late Friday afternoon after we taped the show. We love when that happens, right?
Yes.
But it was big news. Doug LaFollette resigned after serving only about 3 months of his 12-year term, and Governor Tony Evers decided to appoint former state treasurer Sarah Godlewski, who was also a former U.S. Senate candidate who dropped out, who was one of the several that dropped out in just the final weeks before the race. So, first, let's talk about why this is becoming a big sticking point. Republicans are alleging that there was some collusion, that this was already pre-planned, that Doug LaFollette was just going to win re-election and that he was planning on resigning regardless. Now, Doug LaFollette says he resigned because he just simply didn't want it to keep, you know, operating that office on a budget, I believe, that's only about $260,000 a year. It has barely any duties, and he was sick of not having any more resources to do it. So Republicans are trying to say, well, whoa, wait, what happened here? He's 82 years old, and Sarah Godlewski, maybe she'll run for higher office. So they passed a resolution this week that won't do anything, but they called on Evers to call a special election. They're saying, hey, you know, this is unfair. There was a tight race against La Follette and Amy Loudenbeck just in November. It was about a little more than 7,000 votes, which is close to a recall. And so there's both sides arguing this for sure, JR, but Evers has no intentions of calling a special election.
So let's first talk about Doug La Follette. I understand the point of view from Republicans that something seems amiss. I'd also assume that Doug La Follette, who we both have covered for a while, had the political foresight last spring sometime to tell Governor Evers, look, I'll get to this election. After I get in the office, I'm going to resign. You point somebody else. We'll go from there. That's not really, Doug La Follette's not really known as a master political operator. The question, though, is why did he decide now, less than 3 months into his term, he was tired of running the office on few resources?
Because he's known that.
Yes. In 1995-97, that budget, he went from having 50 full-time employees, roughly, in 1994 to half dozen in the next biennium. They pulled things away. He went from that half dozen, he now has one full-time equivalent employee right now besides himself, and he's moved in 2015 from private office across from the Capitol to the basement of the building. This is no surprise. So why now? Begs the question. Doug has not been taking calls since he announced his resignation. He sent a letter to Evers on Tuesday from the governor, said, on Wednesday the governor met with Sarah Godlewski and offered her the position, and on Friday appointed her. Took office on Saturday. Now, the big question is for Godlewski, what are you going to do with it? So, one, this immediately puts her in the conversation for 2026 for governor, right? Along with Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez, Attorney General Josh Call, assuming Evers doesn't run again. Now, the governor's in his 70s. We've asked him before, you know, run for a third term. He said that'll be made down the road. I think most folks don't expect him to run for a third term. So Godlewski, to her credit, is now in that mix immediately for another statewide run. If she finds a way to use this office to play it smartly and show she's not just doing this for herself but for Wisconsin. She can't just be nakedly political and like, this is my platform to run in 2026, right? How do you do that? Now, you could argue with Godlewski, she could have just as good an opportunity to go back to the private sector, do something there. She created a PAC after she dropped out of the Senate race to help other candidates, fundraise for that PAC, help people, do something in the private sector, just as good a shape. But she has this platform now. How is she going to use it to her benefit? Again, people I talk to kind of doubt that Doug La Follette was like this really schemer in getting into office, but they also say Republicans are smart to raise an issue now, right? Try and make it a problem. Try and add some kind of like question to it. I just don't know if people remember in 3 years how she got the job. But she has to use it properly the next 3 years if she wants to be able to use a platform for something else down the road.
And the governor, under state law, only has the power to call a special election.
He can appoint or call the special election. He's got two options. He chose this one. If you don't appoint somebody, the next election is in April of 2024. So there's that. If you call a special election before then, it would cost basically millions of dollars.
Yes.
It's an office that doesn't do a whole lot. But there is a legitimate complaint of this happened just a couple months into his term.
All right. And mixed this week is Dan Kelly about polling and money specifically.
Talk about the debate. Let's talk about what we're seeing. So Wisconsin Manufacturing Commerce has an issues mobilization council. It's a group doing TV ads knocking Janet Protasiewicz. They put out a poll this week that showed the race within margin of error, 2 points. And it's the movement from a month ago was, again, tightening, but within the margin of error. That poll, though, had 16% of voters being undecided. In talking to people, they're skeptical of that, okay? In 2019, Brian Hagedorn, the conservative, was running against Lisa Neubauer, liberal. She had the financial advantage, much like now, but there was a late surge of money and enthusiasm among conservatives that carried him to a 6,000-vote victory, essentially. There's a thought that there are people trying to say, hey, we're in the same boat as 4 years ago. The difference is, 4 years ago, Democrats were caught flat-footed by the late surge of money. That's not happening this time. What's more, Protasiewicz is outspending, not in dollar sense, but in point sense, the other side. What I'm getting at is, right now, she has got $10.3 million on TV from being the campaign to now, TV, radio, a little bit. That goes way farther than the money I'm seeing. So WMC dropped into $1.4 million on TV. Susan B. Anthony, anti-abortion group, announced $2 million to help Daniel Kelly the last week and a half of the race. That's a lot of money. $1.25 million on TV or digital. But in some markets, Janet pays 1/6 of what they pay for the same amount of time on the air. So even though they may be bringing a lot of money in, she is still beating them on the points late. That poll again, polling in November has become tricky. Polling in April is even more difficult. So one question I have with people is, okay, if think about this. I've now tracked $33, $34 million spent on this race, all right, that I can track. There's probably millions more have been spent that I can't track. If you have a good voter screen in your poll, do you really find 16% undecided 2 weeks out? Now, if you're polling a November electorate and transposing into April, maybe, but people are really definitely going to turn out in a week and a half, people are skeptical of that. But hey, you know, the poll met our standards for publishing it, so it's out there. I just get the impression talking to people that Kelly's still a massive underdog because of the impressions people are getting. So yeah, there's enthusiasm on both sides. Democrat, and this poll suggests Republicans are more enthusiastic than Democrats are, which people are also skeptical about. The impressions, though, there are just so many more impressions from the liberal side, and Procevich is the only one on TV. Ever the liberal group that I see is going on digital and doing GOTV. It's a very smart, corny way to spend the money, and I've talked to Republicans who are already like in post-mortem mode saying, we have to realize the rules of change for the Supreme Court race. We can't do independent groups for our TV anymore. We have to funnel it through the party and the candidate to match what they built the liberal side.
All right. And following this week is Milwaukee's finances. Can't talk.
So new report. We've been talking about the challenge Milwaukee faces without new revenue streams. New report commissioned by MMAC, the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, says it is bad, way bad, starting in 2025. The key thing is looking at the governor's proposal for shared revenue, which he wants to take 1 cent of every 5 cents collected for sales taxes, put in shared revenue. He wants to allow Milwaukee County to impose another 1 cent sales tax and a half cent. That's, I believe, about $160 million a year for the sales tax. Another 83 for the city alone, shared revenue. Even if you take the half split, 80 million bucks from the sales tax, plus everything Giver wants to do, you're still not really covering the full problem for Milwaukee without the city, without taking into account rising costs for people who still work there, healthcare, the cost of materials. That's how dire it is. Republicans continue to go, we feel a little bit like we have to do something, but man, it hurts to try to go for Milwaukee because Evers wants to put more in the Milwaukee Brewers, for example. There are all these things like, why should I help Milwaukee when I live over here? It's going to be a challenge still. So I'm watching to see where Republicans end up with these proposals. And two, is the 1% sales tax enough?
Yeah, we've talked about that before. Is it going to generate enough money, too? Because they've been in the hole for quite some time. There's been dire circumstances like this report that's been going on for many, many years. And I think even Mayor Johnson has told me he doesn't think it's enough. He needs both.
So either 1% by itself plus the $80 million is not enough. So is it 2%? Okay, now you're asking Republicans.
Now you're going to ask Republicans even more money.
And do you allow voters to? They're okay with like the idea of a little bit of okay. If I let voters approve it, that's one thing. You're talking about a community with one of the highest pockets of poverty in the state. You're now going to take a regressive tax, which the sales tax is regressive, and maybe go to 2% more in Milwaukee. Could you imagine Republicans passed a bill allowing Milwaukee to raise its sales tax by 2%, but voters rejected it? There are all kinds of moving pieces of this discussion that's still going on, and they're still not quite there. It could take a while. There's a sense, again, we got to start with Milwaukee, but this underscores how dire it is, and what's on the table right now might not be enough without more.
And one thing to watch for, is it going to be in the budget? Is it going to be a separate bill? So
absolutely.
We'll stay tuned. All right, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.